150 years since the first shots were fired in the American Civil War, and what have we learned from it? Ken Burns' 1990 documentary about the war was the most watched show in the history of public television. It sparked a dramatic surge in interest in the Civil War and in visits to Civil War sites. Ken Burns lives in New Hampshire, travels a lot, produces documentaries for PBS, Civil War, baseball, jazz, the war about World War II, recently national parks. He's won a mantleful of Emmys, and Ken joins us today to talk about the American Civil War. Ken, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Rick. Great to be with you.
You know, there's a lot of movies and documentaries and books on the Civil War. What did you see that was needed? You put a lot of work into this. Did you want to contribute something that was different?
I did. I grew up very much, I was, 8 years old at the time of the centennial of the Civil War. And I remember that it went over my head. The Civil War was something we always talked about. I had a set of army men that I played with my brother that were Civil War blue and gray soldiers. But it seemed to me focused almost entirely on sort of regiments, guns, and armaments, and missed what I thought was the real, I've now come to call it, emotional archaeology of the war. And as I began my professional life many years later, working on films on the Brooklyn Bridge, on the Shakers, on the Statue of Liberty, Huey Long, the American Congress, obviously very diverse subjects, that all of them had as a determining factor this thing called the Civil War looming over it. And it essentially compelled me to treat it in a way that I thought we could engage the elements of my style, that is not just a third-person narrator, the voice of God, but a first-person voices reading the diaries and letters, newspaper accounts, and military orders, that you would energetically explore the photographic record. And, of course, the Civil War is the first war to be lavishly and expansively photographed, that you could bring in period music, and that you could come to know the important military events. They're central, they're the skeleton, but that you would also understand the stakes for a country that had just started 45 years before, with chattel slavery still on the books. We had proclaimed all men were created equal, but we were coming to this head-on collision over that, because in the South, made up of 9 million people out of the 31 or so million people in the United States in 1860, 4 million of them, or 45%, were African American, who did not have a vote themselves, were counted as three-fifths of a human being, and were, of course, more importantly, living under chattel slavery, something that is the complete opposite of the universal freedoms that Thomas Jefferson had articulated and our country was now proudly trying to live up to. So the Civil War was this freight train barreling down my consciousness that needed to be treated.
So, like anybody our age, you know, we grew up with the, you know, stories of the Civil War and, as you said, the soldiers with different colored uniforms, but you wanted to humanize it, basically.
Yeah, and, you know, I basically wanted to find out what happens. I mean, we get, in our teaching, we shy away from military stuff for some reason that's no longer apparently fashionable. We're interested in the causes of the Civil War and its effects. And those are hugely important, of course, and I don't mean to undermine them at the expense of learning what actually took place. So I found myself knowing that, you know, Lee was a Southern general, Grant was North, and Sherman was North, I think, and and Stonewall Jackson was obviously South, but after that, the next echelon, I wasn't sure, so I wanted to find out who won the various battles that I'd heard of, like First Manassas and Second Manassas and Antietam and Gettysburg and Petersburg and Vicksburg, and know what happened in those battles, but also do it from a bottom-up as well as top-down version. That is to say, follow not only Jefferson Davis and Abraham Lincoln and those generals North and South, but what was it like for the so-called ordinary person, what we'd say the grunt today, in the line of battle, sacrificing his all for whatever cause propelled him to that moment. And that, to me, was what we tried to do in our series.
It's interesting, when you think of our decade and you think of the impact YouTube has on just letting everybody share videos, back then in the 1860s, photographs were just as exciting of a phenomenon, such a big improvement in people's ability to share the reality of their experience.
It's really true. You know, Louis Daguerre publishes his first photograph, or makes his first photograph, not published it, in 1839. And by the mid-1850s, there are enough itinerant photographers in the United States that people are getting their photograph taken, and it's this amazing thing. It's democratizing. You know, you would only have a portrait if you could afford. You'd have to be upper middle class or rich to afford a painted portrait, but a photograph had a little bit more of a democratic feel to it, and it explodes at the time of the Civil War, and we believe more than 1 million images were taken with a country obsessed with knowing what was going on. And some of the images that come back are as gruesome and as ghastly as you'll ever see.
Now, your wish to humanize the war and do this emotional archaeology, it sort of dovetailed nicely with the abundance of photographs that were available.
It did. By the time we started, there are probably about 100 to 125,000 photographs. I think I've seen most of them. I know that I, by hand, re-photographed with my movie camera more than 16,000 of them and used 3,000 of them in our series. So I'm pretty familiar with them. And that was the idea, that they would tell the story. We wouldn't need paintings or cartoons or lithographs in much abundance, that we could actually try to communicate that, and a reality that we could, with complicated sound effects, bring alive. So even though there's not a single photograph of battle, everything is taken before or after, we nonetheless tried our best to animate, in the most generous sense of that word, what was happening during the war.
Ken, did you find that people who owned these photographs were pretty generous in their willingness to share this with you, understanding what your motive was?
Very much so, but I have to say right off the bat that most of the photographs, the lion's share of them, are in the public domain. Matthew Brady, the famous and celebrated photographer who was actually a photographer but also the boss of many other photographers who were equally as great artists, went bankrupt after the Civil War, in part because a country's appetite for war photography fell off immensely. And it was the Library of Congress, the nascent Library of Congress, that bought his negatives, and they're all there, or some are in the National Archives and the Military College. So we found maybe 80% of our photographs just within three or four sources that are owned by you and me and everyone listening.
Now, you said the appetite for war photography fell off dramatically?
It was so amazing that the glass plate negatives that they often used in that time were sold, and someone told me that in many cases they became replacement panes in greenhouse gardens around the country, and that some, I think it's more apocryphal than anything, but it bears sometimes repeating these apocryphal stories, made their way into the faceplates of World War I gas masks. If the Civil War did anything, it ushered in modern warfare, which would find its next gruesome, grisly apotheosis in the First World War.
What do you think about the fact that America has not hosted a war in 150 years when we make war decisions?
It is a pretty interesting phenomenon, isn't it? And in fact, I'm drawn back to war all the time. I'm now working on a massive piece on the history of Vietnam. If you think about it, besides the Civil War, let's set that aside for 1 second. When the British burned the White House during the War of 1812, nothing happened on our land until 9/11.
Wow.
Pearl Harbor is, of course, a devastating attack on a territory of the United States which is the most remote place on Earth. That is to say, Hawaii is farther from any other place than any other place on Earth. Lincoln, as a young man in Springfield, Illinois, attended a meeting of the Young Men's Lyceum, which I think is, we'd think of it as like a rotary or at least a speaking club. And there the topic was the threats to the United States. And he was asked, as a young up-and-coming lawyer, to address this. He wasn't even 29 years old. And he said, "Whence shall we expect the approach of danger? Shall some transatlantic giant step the earth and crush us at a blow?" Then he answered his own question. "Never. All the armies of Europe, Asia, and Africa could not by force take a drink from the Ohio River or make a track in the Blue Ridge in a trial of 1,000 years. If destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. We shall live through all time or die by suicide." I mean, this is the guy who would preside over the closest we ever came to near national suicide, the Civil War. But, you know, his words are pretty...
It's true today.
True today.
It's prophetic.
We are insulated by these two great oceans and two relatively benign neighbors, north and south, and that has afforded us, with the exception of the Civil War, of a bloodless history for the most part. Now, though many people talk about the extermination of Native Americans, and that is a huge blot on our history, but we're not talking about that many battles and consequential fights in which we're, as Europe can speak of tens of millions of deaths.
And when we think of the Civil War, it's easy to underestimate how bloody it was. One in 50 Americans died?
It was 2% of the population died. Just think about what that would mean now. If we're 300 million, 2% is,
million.
You do the math. That's a magic number in terms of perishing in a war.
And it wasn't limited to one spot. What was it? It was fought in thousands of different places.
It was permeated all over the place. In skirmishes and major battles, the greatest battle in the Western Hemisphere, Gettysburg, the bloodiest day in American history, Antietam. These are places within an easy drive of our nation's capital. And it's hard to think now, as the decades sort of peel off behind us and the Civil War is so much of our rearview mirror, how consequential it was, not just in American history. Mm-hmm. It is the most important event in American history. More than the founding, more than the Depression, more than the Second World War, certainly more than other events that have recently happened. But we don't really understand it, and that's what we set out to try to put our arms around, some sense of coming to terms. I mean, if you think about it, Rick, before the series came out, the two biggest popular culture things about the Civil War were Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind, all of which turn it upside down.
Very romanticized.
And make a terrorist group one of the heroes. That is to say, the Ku Klux Klan, the original American terrorist group, the heroes. So we've gotten it wrong. We've soft-pedaled the causes of the war, which is essentially slavery. Obviously, states' rights and other things are part of it, but slavery was the big, as someone said, the sleeping serpent that lay under the table during the Constitutional Convention, if not always on everyone's tongues, then on their minds.
Ken, when you think about your goal to humanize the Civil War for Americans 150 years later to properly appreciate it, in retrospect, what was your most powerful technique, your most effective technique to do this?
I think without a doubt, besides obviously working with great writers and editors and co-producers and cinematographers, was the emphasis on the first-person voices and the intimacy with which I re-photographed the still photographs. The combination of that, I think, helped take an event that had been sort of safely put in the past and everybody had superficial opinions but hadn't really dealt with it in a real sense and brought out the human story and the human drama. Most of history and why so many people hate it is its memorization, dry dates and facts and events that seem to us to have little meaning. And what we were looking for, as I said before, is an emotional archaeology that would be the glue that would sort of reassemble the shards of the past into something that could sit before us and we go, oh, yes, I recognize these people. When he writes a love letter home, this is the love I feel for my wife. This is the love I feel for my country, for my government, the love I feel for my family. These are the sacrifices we've been willing to make, I am willing to make. And all of a sudden, the distance, the gap between the past and the present dissolved, I think, in a few moments. And it was, as William Faulkner once said, it's not, history is not was, but is. And we look for those moments where something is vivified, whether it's standing on Little Round Top with Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain beating back a furious charge that might have determined the course of that battle, and then perhaps the Unionist self, whether it's with Lincoln crafting the extraordinary words, not that I quoted before as a young man, but also the House Divided speech, his first inaugural when he appealed to the better angels of our nature and the mystic chords of memory, or the Gettysburg Address, the most famous speech in all of the English language, or his second inaugural, Malice Towards None, you know, Charity for All.
Ken, you mentioned it was the intimacy that you're able to film these old black and white stills, and that must relate to the beautiful pans and slow pushes that you innovated.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of that is so often we treat these photographs like slideshows at arm's length, and we just flash it on the screen, and we get them off as quickly as possible as if we can't wait to get to the relief of newsreel stuff that moves. But, of course, there are no newsreels of the Civil War, so we had to live within the photographs and trust that they were a frozen moment of a much longer and larger reality that we could imagine through sound effects, through first-person voice, third-person narration, and the way we filmed it. So we would use the photograph the way a feature filmmaker would a master shot, seeing both a long, a medium, a close, an extreme close-up, a tilt, a pan, a reveal, that is to say a zoom-out, and some sorts of details, inserts they're sometimes called. And we did all of that and kind of tried to will the past alive, if you will.
And that was the Ken Burns effect, right?
Well, this has now been characterized by Apple as the Ken Burns effect. And I think if you want to pan and zoom over photographs, Apple has something for you.
That's great. You know, when I think about the Civil War and so on, it's just got to be the ultimate family trip when you're raising your kids to appreciate, you know, the greatest American test. Mary in Ocean Springs, Mississippi, emailed us, and she said, "When I was young, very long time ago, my mother would take us to Civil War sites all the time. Every time we moved, the first thing we'd do in our new town was to visit the nearest battlefield or cemetery. At the time, I thought it was kind of boring, but now I think of it as the best ways to learn history. I'm so grateful that our country has preserved these wonderful and important sites."
I agree completely. It is so important, and so important that we see them together. It's not just the sites. When we think about our national parks, it's not just standing on the rim of the Grand Canyon or on a little round top at Gettysburg and what we see. That's hugely important, but who we see them with. And so many memories of people are formed in these out-of-the-ordinary experiences. I went to West Point with a film we made on the Second World War, and I was so stunned to find so many of the cadets, male and female, had been to Gettysburg with their parents after watching my documentary, and were sort of inspired to pursue the military career that serves us all by what they'd seen and felt and learned holding their parents' hands, climbing over the rocks of Little Round Top. And that's quite an extraordinary thing. You stand on the rim of the Grand Canyon, and you're there, and you see the rock that is exposed that's 1.7 billion years old, and you think of how insignificant our own lives are. But then you look down at this bright, you know, apple of your own eye, and you just you realize that there's an intimacy to time as well as enormous immensity to it, as the historian William Cronin says in our film. And I feel the same way about Gettysburg, and since it has a proximity, I know someone who knows someone who fought in the Civil War that's that close to us.
Wow.
So my grandfather knew his grandfather who fought in the Civil War, and so that's an amazing connection.
I love living in the Northwest, but that's a disadvantage for us out here. We don't have any of that heritage handy, so we have to make a point to travel for that. Ken Burns, let's think about some sightseeing ideas. This is a travel show, after all. You've seen a lot of the Civil War sites. What are one of the best, like, visitor centers or museums that really teach well?
It's so easy. I'd go to the nation's capital, you know, where essentially the war began. I mean, it didn't. It's down in Fort Sumter out in Charleston Harbor, but this is the sort of the HQ, at least for the Union. Mm-hmm. And so many things are within an easy drive. There's Harper's Ferry, where John Brown's raid took place. There's Antietam, the bloodiest day in American history in September of 1862. There's Gettysburg, which is not that much farther in south-central Pennsylvania, where the Gettysburg Address was also delivered. There's Ford's Theater, where Lincoln's life came to a tragic end. There's Arlington National Cemetery, whose high house on the hill was Robert E. Lee's original house. And the Quartermaster General of Washington, D.C., was so disturbed that he had run out of burial space, including his son, that he decided to plant some of the extra bodies in Robert E. Lee's front lawn so that he could never return to that house again. And it's now our most hallowed ground when we speak of Arlington National Cemetery, forgetting the great, unbelievably intimate and personal, wrenching story at the heart of its creation. There's the Lincoln Memorial. There's all these amazing things that happened. Lincoln's summer home, just north of town. I mean, this is a place.
This is really, I'm a tour guide, and from a tour guide's point of view, this is a beautiful sort of revelation. You go to Washington, D.C., which is right by the line between north and south, right?
Exactly.
And then within a couple hours' drive, you got a good section of the most important sites to see.
And I haven't even gone west or south for you. That is to the Shenandoah Valley, a hugely important strategic area. There was a little town of Winchester, still there, that changed hands 72 times during the Civil War. Or south a half an hour to Manassas, where the first major battle of the Civil War was fought. Or down to Richmond, only 100 miles away, and below Richmond to Petersburg, where the outlines of World War II and trench warfare were being found. And if you're willing to go 3-4 hours away, you can get to Appomattox Courthouse, where it all ended. You know, the whole war, except for the Western Theater, meaning Tennessee and Georgia and Memphis and New Orleans, is right there before your eyes.
Ken, how many hours is your Civil War documentary?
It's 11 and a half.
11. So you could, like, take a week of intensive, make your own miniseries with your family, get the DVDs, and then as preparation for your trip, and then rent a car in Washington, D.C., and you could have quite an experience. We've got a lot of emails. Terry in San Antonio emailed us from Texas, and Terry writes, I visit the Antietam Battlefield in Harpers Ferry the first week in December each year. There are 25,000 luminaries, one for each casualty placed on the battlefield. That's the first week in December. Harpers Ferry is decorated with period actors, Christmas decorations, and so on. It's a must-see. I also recommend the Bavarian Inn at Shepherdstown in West Virginia. My buddies and I rode a live mule named Bess in a bar with Revolutionary War reenactors. What a great weekend.
And who says history is boring? These are the trips of a lifetime that live with people. Antietam is one of the most moving places on Earth. It's still intimate. It's rural. It's a three-part battle in one day that's very easy to comprehend, even if you're not into military studies. Harpers Ferry is a restored town, and it's a Park Service site, as is Antietam and Gettysburg. And Shepherdstown is a beautiful little town in West Virginia. I've been to a number of times. All of these could be part of your itinerary and more.
As I travel in Europe, there's a lot of very important historic battlefields that are beautifully presented from a teaching point of view. In your assessment, what's the most evocative battlefield that is aided by the way it is presented by the park rangers or whoever organized the site?
Well, you know, it's hard to pick one because our Park Service is one of the greatest institutions. I mean, our film on the National Parks was subtitled America's Best Idea.
Yeah, without saying the best one, because I know you don't want to say that.
Yeah,
but what's a couple of good ones?
I love Vicksburg on the Mississippi, in Mississippi. I like Gettysburg and Antietam tremendously. They have an intimacy, all of them, and the Shiloh battlefield in central Tennessee as well, all because you can get to them and sort of blot out the modern things. You can even sort of squint, and the statuary and the interpretive stuff disappears, and you feel on a hot July day like you're at Gettysburg, you feel as the autumn leaves are crunching under your feet and you're walking through some corn near the Dunker Church at Antietam. You can sort of hear the shouts and the ghosts and echoes of an almost inexpressibly wise past sort of rise up and give real meaning and poignancy to what the word travel is. I think Mark Twain said, travel was the greatest assault on the ordinary mind. You know, enemy of the ordinary mind. and Twain is always right.
He's a good traveler. I always got a sense that he was a great traveler.
A great traveler, and one of his greatest books is, of course, a travel book about his Western adventures. But what he was saying is that when we travel, the kind of prisons that we weave for ourselves by staying put and assuming things always get jettisoned. I can't imagine what the founders of the National Geographic must be doing, turning over in their graves. The National Geographic Channel, one of their most popular programs, is Locked Up Abroad, with a notion that it's very easy if you travel to be imprisoned in other places. And I just thought, oh my God, that's the exact opposite of what the National Geographic. We are there to be curious about the rest of the world and the rest of humanity around us and the events that have taken place. And it is our responsibility to get out from our narrow-mindedness and have these preconceptions shattered by reality, that the people in the north aren't as bad as you thought, the people in the south aren't as bad, or east or west, or black or white, or young or old, rich or poor, and all of a sudden we're no longer making distinctions. We understand, as someone writing about the National Park said, we're all just Americans. And that's just within our borders, let alone the kind of bailiwick that you travel, which is our globe.
Right. Is there a site that has a great photo archive right there in situ of that battle?
Because there are none of the actual battle, we would still be talking about a good collection of photographs.
So the art of photography was such that you just simply couldn't take photographs?
The exposure time was great, and that's one excuse, but it's dangerous. People die in the middle of battle, as we know from the dramatic footage we were able to find from the cameraman.
That's interesting. So you can get all the pictures you want of people after the battle nursing their wounds. But
well, what we did is we took a kind of temporal poetic license that when we would show the dead on the battlefield, we do it in the midst of the battle so that we felt like we were in it. And
in
if
it,
we
right.
kept up the sound effects, then it gave you a sense of how terrifying it might be. And that's always the reason to talk about war, because human beings have this strange, funny little thing where they forget the cost of war after a few years and then are suddenly excited to go back to war. And I think if you remind people of what the human cost is, at least they begin to stop and say, is this worth it in treasure and life, particularly human life, to do it? And then hopefully calmer heads prevail, and we only fight the necessary wars.
Well, that's one good reason to travel in places that are recently war-torn, is you get a sense that the next generation is shaking their heads thinking, what was in
what
those people's minds?
You know? And Europe is a particularly poignant example
it
because
sure
you
is.
Think of them as so cultured and sophisticated and grown up to the kind of, you know, pimply adolescence that we Americans have in the historical perspective.
Yeah.
But in fact, Europe is a site of ravaging civil wars that, unlike ours, had very few civilian deaths in ours outside of the state of Kansas and Missouri. Very few civilian deaths.
Huh.
The European civil wars were all about wholesale slaughters of cities and towns and hamlets and villages and just the worst depravity of human behavior that you could imagine, sometimes all in the name of church or all in the name of state or all in the name of just conquest and acquisition. But, you know, we have been graced that the only thing that went over our land was this civil war.
Are there ways that the war is still being fought that you felt in your work?
Always. I think when you scratch the surface of American history, the great sub-theme is race. We still wrestle with it today. We have an African-American president, and we have a level of vitriol and rhetoric in our conversation that sometimes crosses the line, based not on the content of his character or policies, but on the color of his skin, the sort of exact opposite of what Dr. King wished for us all. I think that in some ways the legacies and divisions sometimes pop up. You can still go down to the South and they'll say, well, you're just a Yankee, or some such assumptions that those people in the North might feel about Southerners. And so I think that the Civil War is a great teaching tool, not only for what took place 150 years ago, but for what's taking place now and about what our country's made of.
What good was lost in the defeat of the South?
Well, I think there was a way of life, a kind of thing that's it's too often romanticized. I don't mean the chivalry. You know, Sir Walter Scott and his world died in the Civil War. The aristocracy died in the Civil War. And for many people who believe in small-d democracy, that was an important change. I mean, the world was now inherited by middle-class chaps like Abraham Lincoln and Sherman and Grant, and not the aristocrat that a Robert E. Lee or a Jefferson Davis represented. It's interesting that the war was almost immediately forgotten by the North. The South, because it had lost, nurtured its wounds, and in some ways the manifestations have been unpleasant, sometimes persistent racism. But more often than not, the greatest literature in America has come out of the South and the tensions of all of those things. Mark Twain, Faulkner, Eudora Welty, Walker Percy, Shelby Foote, all of these great writers are all trying to negotiate the fact of loss. And that is, of course, something that visits us all personally, but here it visited a whole region of a country, and it produced extraordinary outburst of creativity that I don't think has diminished.
150 years later.
Yes.
Ken Burns, this project of yours must have been successful beyond your wildest dreams. The first aired in 1990, the most watched program ever on PBS, coming back again in 2011. How has this project been most gratifying to you?
I think in just the fact that here we are 21 years later and we're talking about it still. The effect has been so profound. I can visit a battlefield and people will run up from their cars with dog-eared copies of our books or DVDs and say that each night in the motel as they tour the battle sites, they look at an episode and they're so stunned to find me there. And we have conversations that are not about celebrity or bold-faced names. They're about our ancestors, mine as well as his or hers. And that's immensely satisfying. It means that we can have a broad reach but still remain with the intimacy of the conversation.
Ken Burns, thank you so much for your commitment to help us Americans find out not only who we are, but why. Best wishes.
Thank you. That's very kind.
Rick Steves has spent a third of his adult life in Europe researching and writing guidebooks. His classic, Europe Through the Back Door, teaches the skills of smart travel. And his country, city, and snapshot guides cover what to see, where to eat, and where to sleep for every corner of Europe. To learn more about Rick's books, visit the travel store at ricksteves.com.